Thank you very much. Okay, thank you for coming. I think there are a few new people, I think. Hello. Well, we can meet and say hello later. So just very, very briefly to sort of to pick up.
While you're here listening, because otherwise it gets left behind.
Oh, eight, yeah. Last time I had to do it only at the end, right? This time I think, okay. All right, so last week we discussed a little bit how Megillat Esther is, the book has absolutely no context. We don't know when it happened. There's no historical context to the book. And it's very strange why the book is part of our Tanakh, why it's part of the Bible. It's sort of a silly story. By the way, we didn't say, how long a time period is the story? Like when you hear it in shul, it takes half an hour, right? But the events from the Vayhi v'Meach Hashverosh till the end, and we said the end is the paying of taxes. That already tells you the book, what kind of a book ends with the paying, the Jews paid extra taxes. That's how the Megillah ends. Achashverosh raised taxes. After Pesach, you know, we left Egypt. On Shavuos, we got the Torah. And at Sukkot, we came to the land of Israel. You know, but what happened on Purim? Nothing happened. Nothing happened on Purim. We discussed that last week. But how long a time period is the story take place? Anybody know?
About a half a year.
Half a year. Right or wrong?
I said about 9 years.
9 years. Why would you say that?
I seem to recall it was a few years.
Well, why don't we take a look? So the first verse of the Megillah is Vayihi b'Meach Hashverosh, right? Bishnat Shalosh L'Malko. The second verse begins in the third year of the reign of Paro. Okay? And Esther is appointed when? So Esther gets appointed in the second chapter, I believe, right? The second chapter, the beauty contest, we'll discuss that hopefully a little bit. And in verse 16, Vathilakach Esther, she was taken, right? Alamelech Achashverosh Abayim Achdo, B'chodesh HaSiri, in the 10th month, Hu Chodesh Teveit. By the way, this is the source of our Hebrew months, like that we call, in the Bible, there are no names for the months. Like Pesach is B'chodesh HaRishon, and Rosh Hashanah is B'chodesh HaShvi'i. There are no names for months in the Bible. Months don't have names. These are non-Jewish names that we adopted, and you have them really for the first time here in the Megillah. The 10th month is the month of Teveit, Bishnat Sheva L'Malchuto, in the 7th year. So there was a 4-year gap between the party and the appointing of a new queen. So apparently, they had to have a year in perfumes, right? The girls had to sit for 1 year in perfumes. So it took, and they had to gather every you know, maiden, young maiden, whatever, from 127, you know, countries, whether that number is made up or just an allusion to Sarah. So it took 4 years till they appointed. And then there was a plot to kill the king. That comes right afterwards. That's really the background. That's how Mordechai, that the whole story changes on this plot, because it's Mordechai overhears the plot. And then he tells Esther, and Esther tells the king, and the rabbis in Pirkei Avot say that whoever says something in the name of who said it brings redemption to the world. Most people like to take credit. They don't like the plagiarism, you know? We don't like to give, if we come up with an idea, even if somebody else comes with an idea, if we say we don't like to give credit to other people, we like to take it. So in our tradition, we're always supposed to say the source. It's not an embarrassment to say I'm quoting somebody else. That's all. I don't say anything original. I just quote other people, and you put it all together. So because Esther could have said to Achashverosh, there's a plot against you. She didn't have to say anything about Mordechai. She would have looked even better, apparently. But she said Mordechai, and then Achashverosh wanted to know what's done to Mordechai, and that's how the whole story turns on this notion that Esther told Achashverosh that there was a plot. It was Mordechai who discovered the plot. So what year is this? So then they appoint Haman. We'll get there in a minute, or in a few minutes. And Haman wants to kill the Jewish people. What else is new? Okay, so where's the verse? Verse 11, chapter 3, verse 11. Vayikra'u Sofrei HaMelech B'chodesh HaRishon. And the scribes came in the first month, B'shlosha Sar Yom, the 13th of the first month. We alluded to this last week. The 13th of the first month is what, by the way? What do we call that in our religion? The 13th of the first month. We call that Erev Pesach. Okay, Erev Pesach. But, you know, the day before Pesach, the next night is the Seder. right? The 13th of Nisan, the 13th of the first day. This is when Haman does the plot. This is when he decides he's going to wipe out, the Jews, right? And and it says they went, verse 13, you know, to really wipe him out, everybody, every last Jew, where's the verse? I know it. Did I miss it? Where does it say it's in the 12th year of the king? Verse 7. I'm sorry, I missed it. Oh, 7. Okay? So that was in the 12th year. So there's a 5-year gap between Esther gets appointed and Haman decides to kill all the Jews. So the story Purim, up to now we've got 9 years. And the rest of the story pretty much takes place between the 13th of Nisan and the 13th of Adar, right? They were supposed to kill the Jews exactly 11 months later on the 13th day of Adar. I have no idea if that's connected to number 13. I assume not, but whatever. And then sometime after that, so it's even more than 9 years, Achashverosh puts taxes on the people. So this is a 10, 12-year story. And if you lived through it, you probably didn't notice anything. In other words, there are many, it wouldn't be the first time in Jewish history somebody tried to kill us. Okay, and thank God we're still here. And, you know, in other words, but no great event happened. And to tie together all the loose ends, remember, there's no miraculous events. So if you just think about the story itself, it takes place over a long period of time, and nothing really happened. So we said the Megillah is the book of how the Jew has to live in exile. That was the bottom line of what we said a little bit, because therefore there is no context. The Megillah, it repeats itself in generation, and it's really, as David Silver puts it, it's the book how a Jew lives without God, without God being manifest in our world. I'd like to say, in other words, the first 1,000 years of our history, God tells us what to do. So our job is to listen to what God says, through Moshe originally, and then through the other prophets, Yeshayahu, Yechezkel, Yonah, you know, Micha. It tells us all the, so our job is this. Not that that's so easy, we didn't do such a great job, but at least we know what we're doing. Esther, which means hidden, means God is hidden. We don't know what to do anymore. So first we have to figure out what's the right thing to do. And the two Jews, three opinions at least, you know, there are 47 parties running in the Israeli election. It's like insane. 47 parties are running. So only 11 of them are going to get in. It's also a little bit insane, right? How many parties do we have in Canada? You know, okay, what can we do? So, you know, we don't know what to do. We have different opinions, and then we have to do it. So Esther is the story of the Jew in exile. That's also, it's connected, of course, because God dwells in the land of Israel. God doesn't really live outside the land of Israel. It says in the Torah, that's a verse in the Torah, that God looks at Israel. He has great vision. So the I don't know what this means exactly, but the peripheral vision of God, he can see the rest of the world. But the Jewish fundamental belief is that God resides in Israel. The Torah is only meant for the land of Israel. Maybe I shouldn't say this, but the Ramban, Nachmanides, develops the theme that mitzvot are only practiced outside the land of Israel, because the Torah was meant for Israel. Half of the Torah only applies in Israel. Anything nationalistic Torah. You can't create a social welfare system in Canada. You can't create a justice system that follows the laws of the Torah. More than half the Torah only applies. The only individual mitzvot apply out here. So the Megillah is missing God, right? It's the story of the Jew in exile, the Jew without God, and that's the way it's been for the last 2,000 years. A believing Jew believes God is behind the scene. A non-believing Jew believes it's, you know, a coincidence. Okay, that we can't prove one way or another. Now, what's the first story? This, I believe, how we ended last week. What's the first, who's the first Jew who lives in exile? That's such a hard question. Abraham. That's interesting. So we mentioned Abraham lives in Egypt. I mean, he goes to Egypt. Okay, but he doesn't really live his life in exile. Or let's say, who's the first Joseph? Jew who flourishes in exile? Of course, is Joseph. And we mentioned there are a lot of parallels between the story of Yosef and the Megillah. And we mentioned last week how Megillat Esther, which is really the last book or one of the last books in the Bible, of the 24 books in the Bible, is playing off other books. 127 is a reference to Sarah. Sarah was taken by the king of Egypt, just like Esther was taken. You know, that the author of the Megillah, and we're not, whether that's Mordechai, Esther, or the Anshei Knesset Hagdolah, right, the author of the Megillah was clearly playing off other books. And then the story he was playing off the most is the Yosef story. So let's throw out a few ideas. What's the parallels between the story of Yosef and Megillat Esther?
Being the king's favorite, Pharaoh's favorite, being the king's favorite.
Okay, so first of all, so who do we have? We have a foreigner, right? I mean, Esther is basically a nobody. We don't even know who her parents are. We know anything about her. Mordechai told her that's very strange. Okay, Yosef is, of course, a foreigner, a lowly slave. You know, Nar Ish, Nar Eved Ivri, as the butler referred to him, right? A Nar Eved Ivri. Okay, so we have two foreigners who rise to power in the most powerful nation of the world. Okay, at the time. What else?
They're both, in a sense, slaves.
They're both?
In a sense, slaves.
Right, they both, in a sense, are slaves, as we're going to see. Very good. Okay, they're beholden to their masters, right? Esther can't even approach Achashverosh. Yosef needs permission to bury his father. He's got to ask to go leave Egypt. Okay, they're second in command, but they're second in command. Okay, what else? How do they rise to power? Not sleeping. Chazirish didn't really have a dream as much. He couldn't sleep, but because of the inability to sleep, Paro couldn't sleep. He twice woke up in the middle of the night, and he couldn't wake up. Good. And how else? Else they're both good looking. The Torah, when does the Torah tell us that Yosef is good looking? Right. In other words, when they tell us that Rivka is, or Rachel is good looking when we first meet her. Like, normally that's when the Torah tells us something, or that Sarah, you know, when the Torah tell us that Sarah was, you know, you're pretty? When does the Torah tell us that? When they're about to go to Egypt. On the way to Egypt. Because that's when they were concerned that now, they're gonna take you. They're gonna take you into the king's harem. So now I have to be concerned about your good looks. But Yosef, we know the rabbis are critical of Yosef. He's sitting there, you know, twirling his hair and makeup. I don't know what else he was doing exactly, but the rabbis are critical. He was a 17-year-old immature kid who was very obsessed with his looks. And then because of that, Potiphar's wife. But that's the whole story. That's just some of the broad outline of the story. We'll see as we go through the Megillah. I don't know how much exactly we'll see here, but if whatever we don't pick up in class, when you hear the Megillah on Purim, take Parshat Vayeshev, Miketz, Vayigash, and you'll see the language, like 50 times, the language of the Megillah is the exact, Vayefket HaMelech Pekidim, it's the same language, Vayema'ein, Vayema'ein Hamalka Vashti. Vashti refused. Vayema'ein, when Potiphar's wife tried to go and seduce Vayema'ein. It's these words that are sort of odd words that appear very often nowhere else in the Bible. And they appear in the story of Yosef and they appear in the story of Esther. So it's without a doubt that, because the wordplay, in other words, the wordplay is very nice. It's very cute. It's nice literary analysis. But of course, the real thing is what's the meaning? The same way Yosef rises to power. Now, what's the end of the Yosef story?
Saves his family.
Saves his family, good. And then what happens? See, it's not all, what happens next? Nice. What happens when Yosef dies? Where's he buried?
His mom was buried in Egypt.
Yeah, why is he not buried in Israel?
Can't be,
right? It was hard enough to get, and that's why Yaakov makes Yosef swear to bury him in Israel, because he was nervous. Yosef became a real Egyptian. Esther became a real Persian. Mordechai said, you know, Esther doesn't want to go so quickly to save the Jewish people. She's not so sure. She basically was assimilated. She was assimilated. Yosef also assimilated. I mean, he came back. That's why he's called Yosef HaTzadik. But he's the only one who gets the appellation. There's Avram Avinu and Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron HaKohen. Yosef is the only person known as the righteous one. So perhaps because he resisted the advances of Potiphar's wife, That's one idea. But also the fact that Yosef really was, and they are connected. Yosef is on the brink of leaving the Jewish people. The rabbis portray it as if he saw the image of his father. It's a beautiful portrayal in the Midrash that he was about to sin with Potiphar's wife. That's why there's a shalshelet. Who here reads the Torah? You know what a shalshelet is? Everybody reads there. Everybody's so smart here, you know.
We have a lot of Torah readers.
Right, that's Yosef. So that's the note of hesitation. There are only four of them in the Bible, famously. And all four are about hesitation. Vayit mama. Who's that? Vayit mama. He tarried. He waited. Who? Lot. And Vayomer, I think it's Vayomer. Who was that? Eliezer, or the servant of Avram when he was about to find the wife for Yitzchak. The rabbis say he had his own daughter. He wanted to marry Yitzchak. He wanted to become a mechutan Avram. What is that? The schlep halfway around the world. And the fourth one? Anybody know? There are three in Bereishit, and they're all famous. By Lot, didn't want to leave. His money was in storm. What's he going to leave for? Keep going where his money is. I'm sorry? Excellent. When Moshe Rabbeinu has to dress Aaron, a Kohen, and pass over the Kuna, like many great leaders, they don't like to delegate authority. Because nobody can do it better than they, which usually is true. But still, you can't do it all yourself. That's what Yitro told Moshe. And that's, in a sense, Moshe wanted to be the Kohen. Well, why split the kahuna? So he had to give it up. So he gave it up. In all four instances, the people did what they were meant to do. In other words, they all acted as they should act, but all with notes of hesitation. So Yosef, so the rabbis say he was about to sin, and he saw an image of his father, and his father was telling him, as we read this week in Shul on Shabbat, the high priest is going to wear a breastplate, and there are going to be 12 tribes listed. Do you want to have 11 tribes listed? We can take off Yosef's name, and your legacy will be lost. You will be like Esav and Yishmael and Lot and all the other people who potentially could have been the Jewish people, right? That's the whole story of Sefer Bereshit, is who's going to be the leaders of the Jewish people. We don't know. Abraham thinks first it's going to be Lot. That's why he takes him. And Lot says he's in for the money. He can't be the Jewish leader. So Abraham thinks it'll be Yishmael. He loves Yishmael. And Sarah says, no, it won't be Yishmael. And God says, you listen to Sarah. It's going to be Yitzchak. And Yitzchak thinks it's going to be Esav. And no, it's going to be Yaakov, right? And then Yosef comes along, and the brothers say, uh-oh, he's going to be the only brother. He wants to kick us 11 out. We're not going to let that happen. That's what the fight's about. Now, eventually, you can't build a nation if only one child in every generation succeeds. Eventually, the nation needs to expand. So that's the story. And then we end, you know, this book of Bereshit ends, and then the story of the Jewish people starts in Shmuck. But what happens after Yosef? Slavery. In other words, the story of Yosef is, and I'm going to sound a little harsh, and this is pointed out by David Silver and Svigra. Other people have pointed this out in more modern times. Yosef, unbeknowingly, of course, but Yosef in many ways was the one who enabled Paro to enslave the Jewish people. How did he do that? How did Yosef do that? Because Yosef centralized power in the kingdom. What did Yosef do? He imposed taxes, like Achashverosh, imposed taxes, and you want to call it ethnic cleaning? It's not a nice word, but you know, he did population transfer, that's what it says in the Chumash, and then he consolidated, everybody had to pay 20% tax, he consolidated all power in the king. You had to go to the central authority to get food. Now, that's probably why Paro liked his interpretation of the dream. Because Paro, Yosef is basically saying, Paro, you're going to be this all-powerful leader. Once he consolidated power, then it was very easy. Then he had control. He knew where everybody was. They had all the records. So it was very easy to enslave the people. Unbeknownst to Yosef, but in a sense, he was the cause, so to speak, of the thing. I mean, it's something to think about what that means. Maybe that's a little bit of a penitent. Maybe Yosef, he was a tzaddik, but still, you know, what he did going to Egypt. I don't know. It's just something. But and that's really the end of the Megillah story. That's another pill. The story in the Megillah ends with taxes. We don't know. Nothing great. Just like the Yosef story, it's what does it say in the beginning of Shemot? Vayaka melech hadash amitram asher lo yada et Yosef. Once you don't know Yosef, then you can enslave the Jewish people. For the first 50 years, no, how can you hurt the Jews? Look what Yosef, he saved Egypt. But after a generation or two, I don't have to tell you the Holocaust, who remembers Holocaust? It's so long ago already, I don't know what to remember. Anti-Semitism is, Baruch Hashem, alive and well and kicking and all over the world. No, it's a terrible thing. For in the 50s and 60s, 70s, it was you couldn't be anti-Semitic. It was not acceptable. Today, it's still not 100% acceptable, so you have to be anti-Zionist, and then you can be anti-Semitic. But then soon you can be just a straight anti-Semite. You don't have to put the veneer of anti-Zionism. No, that has nothing to do with policies. I'm not talking politics. I'm just saying. Anyway, so that's sort of what happened here after the story. Yes, I'm sorry. You had your hand up for a long time.
Just as a aside, I read somewhere that because of the massive rains this winter in Egypt, Yemen, and Saudi Arabia, that the locusts are,
yes,
locusts,
yes,
are huge.
Yes, I saw that.
They're expecting a massive
plague,
deterioration, and famine in those countries.
Okay, that's not right. The plagues can be explained all naturally if you want. I mean, the Rambam was not really a big believer in miracles. Miracles are just all timing. What's the miracle time? There's that this happened then. It's not, miracles can be explained naturally. That's a debate among the commentators. But if you saw yesterday, President Sisi says if the Jews want to come back to Egypt, he'll build shuls. You saw that in the paper yesterday?
Yeah.
They want the Jews back in Spain. In other words, the world's a crazy place. On the one hand, they kick us out and they want us back. And, it's a little bit crazy, but in many ways we have warmer relations with some of the Arab countries than we do with some of the European countries. But I'm not getting involved in politics. Forget it. I spoke too much already. I'm saying it really is a crazy world that, you know, there are some open relations with Arab countries and yet that's another parallel. That's another parallel between the Yosef story and I'll say one more parallel because just
governments, not countries.
Right, the governments, yes, there is a difference, and I saw about an hour ago that the foreign minister of our friends in Iran and Persia were talking, this is after all Purim. It's Purim, I mentioned last week how my cousin in 1970 was in Israel for the year, in Yeshiva for the year, and he went to Tehran for Purim. Israel and Iran in 1970 had great relations. The Shah of Iran, that's where Israel got all its oil from. Israel and Iran were very close. Please God, it should happen again. You never know, it can be a regime change, but the foreign minister there, what's his name? Zarif, just resigned. So nobody knows yet exactly why. Was he thrown out because he's too moderate? We'll have to wait and see. Anyways, but like I say, I only say this comment because I mentioned last week, everything in the Bible is current events. Otherwise, it wouldn't be in the Bible. Nothing in the Bible. The Bible couldn't care less about history. There are historical things mentioned in the Bible, but not because of the history. The Bible couldn't care less about history. And Megillat Esther is the best proof of it. It's totally oblivious to history. It's totally because it's a model. It's a template that we then apply in every generation. Okay, I'll say one other thing. There's more to come along just on that Yosef thing. What happens after Achashverosh and Haman agree to kill the Jewish people? This is the end of chapter 3. Alright, so we read Hanashima, Taf, Narzakin, everybody, man, woman, child, everybody one day wipe him out. Pachek and Akhtab, this is the end of chapter 3. Haratzim Yatsu Duchim Armelech, Badat, Badat Nitna, Vishushan, Vamelech, Vahaman, Yashulishto, that's the custom, you read in the Echa tune. Vamelech, Vahaman, Yashulishto, Vahir Shushan, Avocha, which means what? The king? And Haman went out drinking. They went to the bar. They're going to wipe out the Jews. Let's celebrate. L'chaim. Let's make Kiddush. That's what it says. I'm not making this up. They ran away to tell everybody we're going to kill the Jews. 13th of Adar, get ready. The law was established in Shushan HaMorah. And they went out drinking. Unbelievable. Where do you have that in the Yosef story? The brothers. What do the brothers do right after? I don't have a chumash with me. What's the first? I can check on my phone, but okay. I remember the exact pasuk. What do the brothers do? They throw him in the pit. Chapter 37, verse, I don't know, 20. Guess I'm guessing verse 21, 22. I don't remember exactly. I mean, you have to pay, you just have to read the chumash, you know, just read it carefully. It says, it's a little bit later, I'm sorry. L'chun dat sam to the Ishmaelim, v'ayim karuat mos Yosef, v'ayeshe v'ayeshe v'alecha, v'ayichut tonet Yosef. Where is it? Verse 24. Vayikachuhu, vayish, vayikachuhu. They took it. It's the same language as in the Megillah. Vayikach. In other words, it's the language of, okay, vayikachuhu. No, I'm sorry. They took him. Vayishlichuhu to a bor. They threw him in the pit. Vabor reikembo maim. There's no water in the pit. And they sat down to eat bread. The Torah doesn't tell us the eating habits of people. Everything in the Torah is a moral lesson. Just like there's no history in the Torah, there's no peripheral. The Torah couldn't care less what they ate for a meal. So we spoke last week, they dipped his coat in a goat. So that's why we bring a goat as a korban on a holiday. So the Torah is telling us, not that they sat bread, the callousness, they threw their brother in a pit. But that's exactly what happened here in the story. With Achashverosh. If the brothers can do it to their own brother, well, surely Haman and Achashverosh can do it. That's no big deal. I'll take one more on this thing. I compare it now to the Esav story. Okay? So we'll read what happens. Yaakov steals the bracha. Rightly or wrongly? That's whatever. That's an important question, but not for now. Probably a little of both. So what happens? Esav comes. He's a little bit upset. So what does Esav do? Vayikach vayikven izesh nebamayim. So what does Esav say? Esav says, vayitzak tzaka gedola. Why can't I find it? Here it is. Kishmo Esav et divrei aviv. This is chapter 27. Verse 34 in Breishit, in Parsha Todot, my bar mitzvah Parsha actually, but okay. Kishmo Esav, I should know it by heart. Kishmo Esav et divrei aviv. When Esav heard, his father told him, oh, he figured out. Vayitzak tza'aka gedola umara ad ma'od. And he cried, vayitzak tza'aka, he cried a cry, or he yelled at you, whatever. Gedola, big, umara, bitter, ad ma'od. Where does that expression, what does that sound like? Right after the Haman and the king are drinking, what's Mordechai doing? Chapter 4, verse 1. Vayitzak tzaka gedola umara. He cried tzaka gedola umara. And what do the sages say? It's not a coincidence. The sages are saying we were punished. Because Yaakov made his brother cry a deep, bitter cry, we were punished 1,000 years later in Shushan, 1,500 years later, 1,400 years later in Shushan. Now that's, you have to understand what are the rabbis like driving at? On the surface, that's a little bit like, what do they mean by that? But, I mean, everything, what you do today can have implications 1,000 years later. But it's also applying that, this is obviously a criticism of Yaakov. Even if he was, maybe he had to steal the blessings, but the way he did it and the way he took joy out of thing from Esav, whatever it is, but the rabbi, I mean, it's a scary like statement of the rabbis, but that's where the rabbis read the Megillah and they come across this expression and they say, bango, this is the expression of Yaakov and Esav. And this is, you know, brotherly hatred. Why were we exiled from the temple, from Jerusalem, the rabbis say, because we didn't get along. Hatred's sinat chinam. So this is, it's the overarching thing. So here you have all these parallels to the other stories. Okay, any questions?
What's the meaning of the last sentence in chapter 3?
In the city.
And the city of Shushan was perplexed.
Right, so people, listen, if you're living in Shushan, okay, so what did it say? You know, what's going on in this city? Well, why should they wipe out all the Jews? In other words, are the Jew, what have the Jews done? What do we know about the Jews in the Megillah at this point?
Well, they were pretty well assimilated.
We don't really know anything. The Jews, we don't know anything. The Megillah is a story. In other words, there's an opinion in the Talmud, which of course we don't follow. There's an opinion in the Talmud that you only have to read the Megillah. Okay, there are four opinions. How much of the Megillah you have to read? So, one opinion is you only have to start reading the Megillah from Ish Yehudi Hayabu Shushan Habirah Shmur Mordechai. When we introduce Mordechai, who cares about the party? What does it do with anything? And then there's another opinion, Achar Hadvarim Elu. No, we only have to read the Megillah when Haman is mentioned. That's not so far apart, but, when Haman gets the point, because that's when you have to be worried. And then there's a fourth opinion. No, you have to read the Megillah, Balayla Hahu Nadadash Nadamela. When the king couldn't sleep, who cares about the first half? In other words, what are those opinions saying? Or is who needs the party? Now, obviously, Jewish law and Jewish thought has not accepted that. In other words, the first chapter of the Megillah is the background to the story. If you can't read chapter 3 without reading chapter 1 and 2, you cannot start the Megillah with Mordechai. You have to start the Megillah with the party. The question is why? That we have to discuss. What's chapter 1 doing in the Megillah? There are no Jews mentioned. What does that have to do with anything? That's, you have to ask
yourself. Setting the stage.
Right, it's setting the stage. The question is, in what way? So, you're living in Shushan. There's a big party. The king makes a party. 180 days for all his advisors, whatever. And then a 7-day party for the whole country. Party, Hashtiyakitat, Eino Neis. Well, let's tie a little bit of Canadian, I'll get Canadian politics in a moment. Okay, as a big party. And then all of a sudden, people get a letter. What does the letter say? The 127 countries. What does the letter say?
We're going to kill the Jews.
No. There's nothing to do with Jews. No. They kill, the Megillah never says Vashti was killed. It says Vashti was killed, but there's the assumption that she was killed, but we don't know. She was banished. She was banished.
She had her own party.
She had her own party, and she didn't come. She crossed the king. She defied the king. We'll get and so what happens? So Mimuchan, who's Mimuchan? Vayomer Mimuchan. You can't. We have to change the rules in the country now. What do you mean? This woman, if she gets away with it, then you know what all the women are going to do to their husbands?
That's what she said.
She
told them not to.
I'm sorry. So we're going to have to ask a rule. That the man is the boss in the house. The Yokolisha wherever Beitome the Berko Shonamo. And when a Frenchman marries a Spaniard and the man is from France and the word is from Spain, you speak French in the house. The Yokolisha wherever to Umida Berko Shonamo. You have to speak the language of the husband. You have to speak the language. I mean, it's what the Megillah says. I don't make this up. Right? So it's very strange. So that's what the rabbis say. In other words, the letter was so strange, people didn't know what to do with it. Like, it's such a funny letter. I mean, probably anyways, the men were, that's the, in the ancient world, the women were not so powerful. So now they get this other letter to kill all the Jewish people. They don't, so people are perplexed. I mean, you're right. So they're wondering what in the world is going on. In other words, if you got a letter, if you're an anti-Semite and you get a letter, like, we can kill the Jews in 4 months. What are you probably, or in 11 months, really, or 8 months? They didn't send the letter right away. That's another interesting question. What would you do? You'd start early.
You start early.
Yeah, target practice. No, I'm not joking. Yeah. You kill a few Jews. We'll kill all of them later, but we'll kill a few in the meantime. No, but they didn't do anything because they were afraid. This king, he may change his mind. You don't know what he's like that. So, what is Achashverosh, an idiot, or is he a brilliant politician? And of course, that's really a big debate among commentators. Is he a brilliant politician? Or is he just a total fool? In other words, what do you mean he's a brilliant politician? He got the Jews wiped out and he pretended he knew nothing about it. He was he delegated. In other words, that's maybe a very brilliant move. Or he's just an idiot you can take advantage of who gets drunk and say that. And of course, the Megillah is purposely written in a way. We're not going to go through how you can read the whole Megillah like this, but it's written in a way where you can interpret the Megillah in two different ways. Because again, it doesn't matter which is true, because we're not talking about a person, a chafir. We're talking about, I have a friend who told me, I shouldn't say this, I don't want to talk politics too much, but a good friend of mine who moved to Israel right after a year of he finished his residency, 1 year off to Israel. He's been living in Israel for a long time. So we speak all the time, all the time. We speak, you know, semi-regularly. So he tells me the occupant of the White House is like Ahasuerus. Because, I said, I'm not sure he's so good for Israel. I'm not so sure he's good for Israel. You know, who knows? Because next one, because sometimes he is mainly not bipartisan. I don't know. So he said, listen, he's like Ahasuerus. And I thought that was a pretty apt description of the president, interpret that as you may. But so that's probably what it means. Now, let's get back here. There is one, we don't know anything about the Jews. The rabbis say, did the Jews go to the party in Shushan? What do you think? Did they order kosher food? Let's start that. Today, if you go to a party in Ottawa or the White House, Baruch Hashem, or the White House, the president's grandchildren, only eat kosher food. I mean, it's like astounding. It's mind-boggling that two presidents of the United States have son-in-laws who are Jewish. Here you have grandchildren of the president of the United States in a day school. Like, it's unbelievable the world we live in. It's really, so the Jews in Shusha, today, you get kosher food everywhere. The White House has a Hanukkah party. They got everything in the White House. I mean, you know how many Shomer Shabbos? I mean, I believe Obama had like a lot of Shomer Shabbos people in his inner staff. His chief of staff was, Jack Lew was a Shomer Shabbos Jew. And a lot of, there's a story when he appointed him. So Jack Lew said, okay, if I have to work on Shabbos, it's Pikuach Nefesh, it's nations of national importance, you can work, And then Obama said, no, you keep your day, we'll get other people. No, you don't ever work on the Sabbath. Yeah, that's whatever. Okay, so it's an amazing thing. So what's at this party? Where are the Jews? The Jews are not mentioned.
But they could be there. You're assuming.
So the rabbis say they were there. Now the question, where do the rabbis get this from? And the rabbis say they were there, and therefore what? They were assimilated. It's a great party. And probably not with kosher food. Probably. The rabbis don't say they ordered in from, they got the kosher caterer to come by, the Persian, whatever.
Do you get the sense that the Jews that they're talking about kept kosher?
No, that's the point. That's that they were assimilated. I mentioned last week that there were thousands of prophets. The rabbis say the most successful prophet was Haman, right? I mean, he wasn't. The rabbis say there were thousands of prophets. We only have like 55 of them, 48 men for 7 women, because the other 3,000 whatever are irrelevant for us. We don't care about history. Only 55 have an eternal message. So there are 55 prophets. Esther is one of them, but they were not so successful. They told the Jews this. Oh, who cares? Haman said, "Going to kill the Jews." That was successful. The Jews did, according to the rabbinic reading of the Megillah, which is really nowhere to be found. If we have to, not for this class, we'll try to discover why the rabbis are reading the Megillah like this. Purim is a reacceptance of the Torah. That the Jews on Mount Sinai did not, contrary to what you were taught in kindergarten and in grade 1 and grade 2 and grade 3, and every year your teacher told you, the Jewish people, Nasa v'nishma, that's what everybody knows from nursery. The Jews said Nasa v'nishma. It's not so simple, probably because the Talmud says God had to hold a mountain over the head of the Jewish people, and God said, if you accept the Torah, great. If not, this is your burial place. Drop the mountain. So the rabbis say that, you have a great excuse. I don't have to keep the Torah. I never accepted the Torah. So that only works till Purim, because Kimu v'Kiblu. The Jewish people re-accepted. And we mentioned last week, Yom Kippurim. That's one of the, we didn't talk, right? Yom Kippurim, Purim. Yom Kippur is a day like Purim, because Yom Kippur, we read on Shabbos, the tablets were broken, the Jewish people are dancing around the golden calf, and then Moshe goes up to the mountain for 80 days. 80 days later is Yom Kippur. The Jewish people were given the Torah new on Yom Kippur. Purim is like Yom Kippur, a reacceptance of the Torah. That's how the rabbis read the Megillah. But it's not really there, it's not in the text of the Megillah. But the rabbis don't make it out of the blue. I mean, and that's part of the reason they agreed to put it in the Bible. In other words, it's an important book. But in chapter 1, the Jews are participating. So this, David Silver points out, I mentioned, it's how the rabbis got it. It's beautiful. What does Esther say when she's about to go into talk to Ahasuerus? Esther doesn't want to go in. So Mordechai convinced her, you better go in. Talk to her. I haven't been called for 30 days. Remember, the king replaced God. We spoke about that last week. The king is God, so God's name can't appear in the king. And just like you can't enter the Holy of Holies, except on Yom Kippur, the high priest, can't just go and speak to the king. This is, you know. So Esther's nervous. The Achashverosh may chop her head off, like he did on Vashti, you know, just like that. So she doesn't want to go in. So what does she tell Mordechai when she finally agrees? What does everybody better do? What does everybody do? Have to fast for 3 days, right? Isn't that what she says? So it says, Lech knos et kol ha-Yehudim. Isn't that the expression? If you can find me the exact verse, right?
16.
Verse 16. Thank you very much. Chapter 4. Lech knos et kol ha-Yehudim. Hanim sa'im b'shushan. Where else does that expression appear? Chapter 1, verse 5. Umlo adhaim yasa ha-melech l'cholam hanim sa'im b'shushan ha-bira. Hold on, is that it? Yeah. To the whole people, that's the language Esther used. So the rabbi, and that's what he claims is how the rabbi saw it. The parallel language, all those found in Shushan HaBirah, appears in Achashverosh's party, and appears when Esther tells all the Jews. So the rabbi said the Jews were participated in the party of Achashverosh, and they were punished. This was the punishment. How could you go? And the rabbis are very upset. I'm sure most people know the Ashkenazic custom, this fancy party. Right? You could drink as much as you want and all kinds of vessels. So why is that read in the Echatun? Echatrop? Because the rabbis say this was the vessels of the temple that Nebuchadnezzar had taken when the temple was destroyed. They took all the vessels. And this was, there was the prophecy of Yirmiyahu that in 70 years the Jewish people would return. Achashverosh calculated that the 70 years were up and therefore the Jews are now returning. I can celebrate. That's it. The Jewish people don't have to worry about them anymore. So he took out the vessels of the temple and the Jewish people are drinking, having a party, drinking from the vessels of the temple. We discussed last week how the people in Israel are not so happy with the Jews living in Shushan. Why are they living in Shushan? They could come back. Cyrus the Great gave the Jews permission to come back to the land of Israel. What are they doing still living in the exile? Right? So there's a lot going on here in a sense. But, the Megillah sets up the first chapter sets up who Achashverosh was and how he acts on a whim. Now, the rabbis identify what happens? So, the rabbis say that Achashverosh was a commoner, and Vashti was the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. Vashti had the yichus. Achashverosh was a nobody, and Vashti had the yichus. But that bothered Achashverosh a lot, and he wanted to be the king. It's like Queen Elizabeth. Really, it was Queen Vashti, and Achashverosh happened to marry the queen. And that's why the Megillah of Vayhibi Me Achashverosh. The only time in the Megillah that Achashverosh's name lacks the notion of king. Because they introduced, he's just Achashverosh, he's a nobody. He became a somebody because he married Vashti. And you see this, and that's why he wants to call Vashti to demonstrate his power over her. And that's why the whole notion of if you let Vashti get away with it, all the women are going to rebel against her husband. Achashverosh he's a brilliant politician. He's establishing his credentials as the king. What does he do? You throw a big party. What happens when he appoints Esther? See, we spoke about him raising tax at the end of Megillah. What happens when Esther becomes the queen? Chapter 2. What is Esther becomes the queen? There are 10 parties in the Megillah. 10 times. There are 10 parties. As Esther, you know, saves the Jews at a party. Come to the party. Only you and Haman come to the party. Right? Get Achashverosh a little jealous. Why is she inviting Haman, you know? There are all these parties. So when Esther is appointed, what does it say? It says that, what have we read before? That she was appointed in the month of Tevet. Vayas HaMelech Mishteh Gadol, verse 18, chapter 2, verse 18. Vahanacha l'midinot asa. He lowered the taxes. Give a tax break. Why does the Megillah tell us that? It's economic policy. He lowered the taxes of the people because he wanted to be loved by the people. There are two ways a king can establish his authority, through democratic means or through a dictatorship. You can be an authoritarian, you know, whatever, rule with an iron fist, kill all the, send your people to the embassy in the other country and knock off your critics. Or you can get the love of other people. So how does Achashverosh begin? The love of the people. A party. 180 days, free bar. Hashtiyah kadat einones. Lasot kirtson ishvish. You can do whatever you can do. Do whatever you want. Except what? What can't you do? You can't go against the king. You can do whatever you want, except if the king says something. I said a talk on Canadian politics. You can decide who you want to charge and who not. It's up to you. I don't direct you what to do. You do whatever you want. Just if you don't do what the king says, things happen to you. Okay? Right there. Maybe it's too obvious. But, I mean, it's so clear. This is exactly the story, right? So you can do, it says, do whatever you want. So Vashti doesn't want to drink. She doesn't want to come. What do we do? All of a sudden, you can't do whatever you want. Now, you'll notice the Malbim points. Malbim lived 100 years ago. He was a biblical commentary who focused on word differences. Like Tov and Yafel. Like he would take two synonymous words. Why does the Torah use Af and Chema? You know, anger, two words for anger. So why did the Torah use Af? This was one of the things he did. He was like a master at beautifully explaining what's the difference between simcha and sason. You know, all these words that sound alike, and he would show you how they know. They have a clear difference, and the Torah uses them in particular ways. So he points out that that Vashti made a party, and when Achashverosh calls her, what does he call? Lavi at Vashti Hamalka, right? But Achashverosh says in verse 11, bring Vashti the queen. In other words, who's she? She's not Queen Vashti. She's Vashti the queen. Why is she the queen? Because I'm the king. She's Vashti the queen. Happens to be the queen because she's married to me. And one verse later, what does it say? But Timain Hamalka Vashti. And Queen Vashti didn't want to come. What do you mean? I'm the queen. It's just this little, from the Megillah going for Atima, he called Vashti Amalka, but Batima Ain, Hamalka Vashti, and this is the word Batima Ain, the same word that Yosef, when the advances of Potiphar, that he reject, Batima Ain, he refused. And the rabbis understand that, the rabbis even say that he wanted, this is probably where they're getting it from, the word Batima Ain, the sexual advances, the rabbis say he wanted her to come naked. He wanted her to dance without any clothes on to show her beauty, and that Vashti wouldn't hear for this. The king is drunk, is nuts. And that's what he wanted. And they even say, it says, Lahavi etvak ishlivnemelk beketer machut. Let her come in her crown, in her queen. So the rabbis say, in her crown, but nothing else. Beketer machut, but no clothes. Okay. That's, again, this doesn't have to be the actual reading, but it's the way the rabbis are showing Achashverosh is trying to establish his authority. Yes?
Why did he have to consult to find out what to do with it?
Beautiful. So this is the Megillah poking fun of Achashverosh. The Megillah can be read as a satire. Achashverosh thinks he's this all-powerful king, and he needs to convene a cabinet meeting. Has to have a cabinet meeting of seven people, and we don't know who these people are. We'll see in a second. Where are they? 14. There are a whole bunch of them. There are 14 different ones. That's again the aura of this king, you know, bureaucrats and the minister of this and the minister of that. What verse are we up to? 14?
14.
Kadama la sot v'karav, right? Who did he call? Karshla sheitar admatatar, she's meris mursurasanam umimuchan. Right? Shivat sarei parasamadai, repnei amelech. What should we do? So it's making fun. He thinks if he can't make a decision. And of course, what do the rabbis say? What happens when Haman says, let's wipe out the Jews? What does Achashverosh say? Oh, sure. Here's my key. Here's my ring. Stamped. So that's the Megillah. To decide what to do when Vashti wouldn't come, he has to have a cabinet meeting. And have the whole thing. To wipe out the Jews? No problem. Let's go drinking. Let's wipe out the Jews and go for a drink. Now, the rabbis say, who is the one who told them what to do? And this, by Yomer Memuchan, Lifnei Melech Basrim, Lo Al Mal Melech, we're verse 15 here, 16. Lo Al Melech Levado Avta Vashti Hamalka. She's not just rebelling against the king. Ki Akola Sarimba, Akola Amim. She's the whole country, she'll destroy the country. If you let a woman get away with it, that's the end of the empire. Right? Asher b'chol medinot ha-melech ha-shurash. Ki ken yisei dvar ha-makol kon shindu. All the women are going to now rebel. It's unbelievable. I'm just translating the words. Lavzot bein valeim b'neim. They're going to degrade, disgrace their husband. V'yamram ha-melech. Because they heard that ha-melech ha-chashverosh, the king ha-chavir, said to bring Vashti ha-malka, right? Not ha-malka, Vashti. That low-life Vashti, the queen. Lefana v'lo-ban. She didn't come. Avayom ha-zeh. Haman goes on. He's giving like a 20-minute speech. You got to get angry. Whole thing. Okay. Who's Memuchan? I don't know. Who's Memuchan? So, first of all, what does the name mean? What does Memuchan mean? He's prepared. Muchan. He's preparing for something. Vayom Memuchan. Memuchan lepornu, to do evil. Who's Memuchan? He's Haman. The rabbis say he's Haman. So by Memuchan is Haman. So why? So this year when they read Memuchan? Okay. Okay. Then people, whoa, okay. So, yes.
I was just going to say, if you go back to the thought that you had that the kingdom was really Vashti's by Nebuchadnezzar.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and while she was queen, then maybe he was the consort, and he needed the cabinet to oppose the queen.
I mean, he hadn't established his authority yet.
Once he got rid of the queen, he could do what he wanted because he wasn't...
Right, and you understand why he is willing to have a queen who he doesn't know who her parents are. Ain't Esther Magedad Molahem, because you understand, Esther's a nobody. In other words... That works in beautifully. To a king who wants that power, I don't need some upstart queen. So it works in to take a queen who has no yichus at all, you know, so to speak. Now,
that's why he was ready to steal
Now, why do the rabbis say Memuchan was Haman? It's very nice, okay. Whenever the rabbis make a comment, where are the rabbis getting it from? They don't just make up things. Where do the rabbis get it from? So what's the parallel between Memuchan and Haman? What happened? One woman didn't bow down, didn't come to whatever, dance. And therefore, what do we got to do? We got to...
Kill her.
Well, not kill everybody, but yes. We have to pass a law in 127 provinces because of one person. What did Hamans do?
Because of one.
One Jew didn't bow down to him. One day, God, all the Jews, that's Haman. Memuchan is Haman. I don't care. The rabbis are not telling us Memuchan is Haman. They don't mean Memuchan and Haman were the same person. They probably were not the same people. That means Memuchan and Haman are cut of the same cloth. Now, the rabbis have a beautiful, it's actually Gemara in Chulin, we'll get there in a few weeks in Daf Yomi, those who are learning Daf Yomi. The Gemara says, Haman mean, if they say by Mordechai, Esther, right? I think I mentioned last week, Esther mina Torah minayin. Where is Esther referenced in Torah? It's a funny question. It's an anachronistic question. Vanochi astir, astir panai, I will hide my face. The rabbi saw Esther's hidden, God, we're in exile, there's no mention of God, we're all on our own. So the Gemara asked, Haman mina Torah minayin. Where is Haman referred to in the Torah? It's a funny question. The rabbis are not asking history, they're asking, where is the idea of Haman in the Torah?
It's in Bereshit.
We're in Bereshit.
It's Hamin, something Hamin.
Yeah, you're too smart. I can't, you're not allowed to answer all the questions. You have to give other people a chance to answer. Okay. Hamin Aitza Shershti Bipiti Achol Achalta. Adam and Eve, you heard of them, right? The Garden of Eden. And they do something they're not supposed to do. They eat the fruit. So God comes to man and he says, where are you? Right? So what does he say? He says to him, where's the verse? Now we are naked, right? They knew they were naked. That's a very interesting for another time. Who told you you're naked? Who even knows? Because when the world was created, the physical and spiritual worked in harmony. There was nothing, you know, to be ashamed of. It worked in harmony. Who told you now? Hamin ha'etz. Now, of course, Hamin is Haman. Hey, mem nun. Hamin ha'etz, asher sibitich levitiach lo menuach. The tree. Is it possible that you ate from the tree I told you not to eat from? Hamin ha'etz. That's Haman mina Torah. What are the rabbis saying? What's the connection to Haman? How many trees were there in the Garden of Eden?
Two.
There are lots of no, a million trees. Had God not told him not to eat from that tree, what are the chances he would have eaten from that tree? Zero. He wouldn't have eaten from that tree. Why did he eat from that tree? Only because he was told not to.
Right.
That's human nature. We don't like to, we like to do the opposite of what people tell us. That's what it means to be human. That's why we have to struggle. That's why one who does a mitzvah because they're commanded is greater than one who volunteers to do a mitzvah. That's what our sages, we think a volunteer is better. I don't have to do it. No. Because when you volunteer, you feel good. Do when you want. You when you're commanded, you have an instinctive, I don't want to put them tefillin every day. Get out of here. It's much harder. When you have to do something, it's much harder to do it. And the evidence, so the rabbis say, when you're commanded to do so, commanded to do something, you get a greater reward than if you volunteer to do something good. Gemara says in the context, Rav Sheshit was blind. So he said he'll throw a party. He'll throw a party because he's blind. So a blind person, how can a blind person keep the mitzvot of the Torah? It's impossible. It's very hard. So, and I do the mitzvot as a volunteer. So therefore, I get a greater reward. So I'm going to make a party. Then they told him no. That you get a greater reward if you're commanded. He says, I'm going to throw a party if somebody can tell me blind people are obligated to do mitzvot. So anyways, but that's Hamina ate. So he would have never eaten from that tree. The one tree. He had every tree he could eat from except for one. And he has to go and ruin his life and ruin all our lives, whatever. Right? Right? So, man, what Haman? Every Jew bows down, every person bows down to him. One Pashtinkin a Jew. He doesn't even notice. Look in the Megillah, chapter 3. Haman didn't notice Mordechai's not bowing down to him. Mordechai's an old Jew, most likely. Asher Hagla, Yerushala, Yimi Magala, Asher Haglata, right? Each, who is this Mordechai? He was exiled with the destruction of the temple, most likely. It says, Vayomer Melech, verse 3, chapter 3, why don't you bow down? The king said to bow down. So they told him every day, Vayagidu Lahaman. They had to go to, Haman didn't notice. Somebody told him, that old Jew in the corner there, he doesn't bow down to you. Oh, he doesn't bow down to him. He's angry. So Haman had, Adam HaRishon had everything, and he had to blow it because of one silly tree. Haman had everything, and he ruined his life. I mean, it ended up costing him his life because of one Jew wouldn't bow down. So that's when they say, Hamin ha'etz. That's Haman in the Torah. It's a beautiful way it ties in. Okay, it's getting late. We'll stop here. What I think. But basically, you see, the Megillah is. You have to read the Megillah on many levels, right? The story is not a story. It's tied into themes that we're getting over and over in the Bible, and themes that we're going to get throughout history and the relationship, and what the Jew feels he's very accepted in society and he can participate in the party with kosher, whatever, not kosher food. And you never know. You never know on a whim what's going to be. So, Purim, despite the fact what I said, we don't know what happened, the taxes, the bottom line is we celebrate Purim. Purim's a happy time. In other words, the Jewish people, Purim is really celebrating the eternity of the Jewish people. Even though God is missing, so to speak, we don't actively see God. God is here, and we're still here. We're here 1,000 years later. So please, God, what we'll do, we sort of covered a lot of things in the first two chapters, not everything. We'll pick up, we'll go through a little bit of the book, and anybody have any questions, of course, on any part of the Megillah, I'm happy to answer.
I know someplace was told me that Haman was a descendant of Amalek.
Correct.
And that's where he got his anti-Semitism from.
Right. Right.
Is there any other?
No, and no evidence in the Megillah. No evidence in the Megillah that Haman's the son of Amalek. There, we don't know who Haman is. Haman Agag. But, it's, also from Amalek. But it's the same way. We don't really know who Mordechai is either. Ishu de Mordechai ben Yir ben Shimit ben Kish. It's not the Shaul ben Kish. It's a reference to the name. But, Right, the rabbis read Haman, but why don't we take the Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, of course, explain Amalek Jews are not racist. Unfortunately, it's not always obvious, but Jews are not meant to be racist, and Amalek is not a race. Amalek is an idea. Rabbi Soloveitchik explained, if you look in the Rambam, how he describes Amalek, Amalek is the person who hates the Jew for no reason. Like, the Palestinians are not Amalek. They have a reason. Maybe it's a bad reason, but we can understand why the Arabs hate the Jews. Why Iran has to hate the Jews, I don't get. We live 1,000 miles. What have we ever done to Iran? We didn't take any of their land. Like, even if you want to, but Amalek is a nation that has a pathological hatred of the Jewish people and cannot be, that's Amalek. So Amalek, it's not like who your father is. And the Rambam says, well, Amalek, you have to make peace with them. The Jews always have to offer peace. We don't have this racist notion that you can wipe out somebody because they're a member of a nation. The Rambam describes whenever you go to war, and the Rambam has the laws of war, and we have a whole section how Jews are supposed to fight, unfortunately. So the Rambam writes, you always have to give the enemy a way out. You can never surround the enemy totally. You always have to let them escape. That they don't be. You always have to offer peace. You can never go to war without offering peace. And okay, whatever, how, but how this applies in modern world is not so easy. I'm not discussing this in a political sense really today. I'm just, I make my comments here and there because whatever.
So when it says Machot Ibchet Zecher Amalek.
Yeah, it doesn't mean the
Zecher Amalek, what does it mean?
It means the idea of Amalek. So could it be that here's another thing. Okay, Amalek is a huge issue, obviously. No, it's because it sounds very, genocide, that's what it sounds like. So it's 9:33. Class is officially over. Anybody can leave. But I'm happy to talk about Amalek for a couple minutes. The rabbis already, by the 8th century BCE, got rid of Amalek. The rabbis, in other words, we know, for example, Root. But maybe we'll have the classes on Root and the proper time. But so Root was a Moabite woman. So you know it says in the Torah that a Moabite people can't convert, right, to Judaism. Did I mention this like last week, I think? Moabite women can't convert. So how do they allow Ruth? And that's why people didn't want to marry her. Ruth can't be Jewish. So that's already before. But the rabbis have an explanation. It's only the male people because it talks about going out in battle and only the men went to battle and therefore it didn't apply to the woman, whatever. But the rabbis then say that we have laws you can't marry and Amon Moab says Sancheiriv came. This is 721 BCE when he attacks Jerusalem and he did population transfers. And we no longer know who's from Ammon, who's from Moab, who's from any country of Amalek. So on a certain level, this is more complicated, but on a certain level, what the rabbis did, is the rabbis right away got rid of any class. There's no Amalek. We don't know who Amalek is. We don't know who Ammon is. We don't know who Moab is, right? Amalek, the way the most commentators say Amalek is a concept. It's true Amalek was a people. At one point, Amalek was a people. So I don't know. At some point in history, we did have to go to battle with Amalek. But the Rambam says, even when to battle with the real Amalek, you had to offer them peace. Couldn't just wipe them out. That's terrible. If they go to war with you, Amalek are the first terrorists. What did Amalek do? We had nothing to do with Amalek. We left Egypt. Well, what does Amalek want from us? They attacked the woman and the children from the rear. Terrorists. They're the first. What do you do to terrorists? You wipe out terrorists. That's all. I mean, that's really what Amalek is like. But it doesn't, in practice, I mean, the idea that, we would kill people, that's just abhorrent, But the rabbis say, we might as well, since Haman was from Amalek, correct, that's what they say. There's no 100% evidence. B'nei Baniv shel Amalek lam the Torah b'nei Brak. The grandchildren of Haman, I think it's by Haman they say, learn Torah in b'nei Brak. That's what the rabbis say. In other words, And Rav Kook, I believe it's Rav Kook, it's basically Newton's third law of physics, right? Everything that's true in the physical world is true in the spiritual world. So Newton's third law of physics, for every opposite, for every reaction, there's an opposite and equal reaction. So for every power for evil, there's an equal power for good, and vice versa. That's why a Baal Tshuva, a penitent, a person who grew up non-observant, can observe this on a higher level. Someone who sinned, and then decides to change their life is always going to be much greater. A person, you know, and let's give a really bad example. A person who grows up in a, where I go, in a typical Orthodox shul, I know it's like in the conservative shul, it's not as bad. Everybody talks. Not everybody. People talk. A Baal Tshuva doesn't talk in shul. Because it's like it's a different mechanism. Maybe it's not a good example, but the idea is that when you sinned and then you repeated, you want to make up for all the lost time. You're really dedicated to reaching a goal, all the lost years. So from Amalek, who's the lowest of low, can come the highest of the high. From Amalek can come, and that's why the rabbis say the descendants of Haman are learning Torah. So there's more to discuss, but in practice, none of this vibrates. But the rabbis do see the Megillah as a little bit of a story between the battle between Amalek and the Jewish people. It's not a battle we want, but it's a battle sometimes we have to fight, you know. Okay, thank you very much. Please, God, we'll see you all on next week.
Welcome back next Monday, 8:30 p.m.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
Bring a friend.
Bring a friend, okay?